when I was in law school, I just remember being so frustrated by so many things and just infuriated. And I would sit there with the Charlie Brown, like, dark cloud over your head all the time. And then I remember one time I was like, I'm going to just go off right now. I can't listen to this anymore.
Carlton Williams remembers his constitutional law class discussion about running from police quite clearly, even 20 years later.
And I raised my hand and I said, look, it, where I live and how I grew up, if you see the police and you are young, running is a completely normal thing to do. And I've personally done it many times. I've seen the police and been like, you know, when I was a kid and the police roll up down the street and you see them on creep, like you see them like they are looking for something. And you're like, I don't want to deal with this. Why do I want to deal with this? I live in this neighborhood. I know there are three alleys. I know there's a tree back there. I know there's a retaining wall. And I know I can go through the hole in the fence. And I know that if I go that way, no one's going to follow me. And I know there's 10 other kids that are standing on the block playing catch or something with me that they're going to do the same thing. And that is a rational thing to do when you've seen someone punched in the face by police. It's a rational thing to do when you've seen someone beaten with clubs.
To Carlton and plenty of other people, myself included, running from the cops can seem like a completely rational thing to do. But generally, the courts have not agreed. Until Jimmy Warren.
SJC 11956, Commonwealth v. Jimmy Warren.
Police arrested Jimmy Warren on an abysmally cold December night in Boston in 2011.
I'm sitting on my porch right now. It happened right down the street from where I'm sitting, like maybe six or seven blocks, because this is like the black, the poor neighborhood in Boston, or several of them, but this is one of them. And you know, Boston is a so-called majority minority city.
That night, police were looking for break-in suspects. Jimmy didn't meet the description they were working with, even as vague as it was. But he was in the vicinity. And when the cops appeared, he ran. They caught up with him, and eventually that led to him getting convicted of illegal gun possession.
People say, you know, the guilty flee where no man pursueth, because they're using biblical precedent.
5 years later, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court overturned that precedent and Jimmy Warren's illegal firearms conviction, ruling, quote, an individual might as easily be motivated by the desire to avoid the recurring indignity of being racially profiled as by the desire to hide criminal activity. In other words, running from the cops doesn't automatically make someone guilty, especially if they're a person of color, given their community's long history of trauma from law enforcement encounters. The court said out loud what many already knew to be true. Racial profiling is real. It causes harm. And to run from the cops is sometimes the logical thing to do.
I was just reading a book called Shielded. It was like, and there was a decision in Massachusetts, and it was based on a report from, it didn't say the ACLU, but it said based on a report about police misconduct.
As an attorney for the ACLU, Carlton helped write that report demonstrating a pattern of racial profiling by Boston police. He also wrote a brief supporting the court's ruling on Jimmy's case after an appeal attempt by the government, which was unsuccessful. But Carlton didn't represent Jimmy.
May I begin?
Yes, please.
Okay. Good morning. My name is Nelson Lovins. I represent the defendant, Jimmy Warren.
Nelson Lovins was the lawyer who actually argued Jimmy's case before the high court and got the decision that attracted so much attention.
On that same day, I got a telephone call from a radio station in Los Angeles. I got a call from CNN, Lawyers Weekly, WBUR here in Boston. May have been a couple of others.
No one talked to Jimmy, though. Even Nelson had never met him. He said that was a first for him in 53 years of practicing law.
I never met Jimmy Warren before the case. I never met Jimmy Warren after the case. I made efforts to find them, could never find them.
When the courts overturned Jimmy's case, they broke precedent. And since then, the decision's been cited dozens of times in Massachusetts. It's not the law of the land anywhere else, but lawyers have still referenced it, trying to support their arguments in several other states and even a few times in federal court. So the fact that no one had ever heard from Jimmy, that we didn't know his story, was pretty unbelievable to me as a journalist. So I went to find him.
Hello.
Hey, Jimmy. It's Emily Previty.
How's it going, Emily?
This is Obscured, the podcast from Kuvenda Media about critical issues that don't get much attention because they're complex, overshadowed, and happen largely out of the public eye. I'm Emily Previty. Fatal law enforcement encounters have understandably and deservedly captured our attention. But the tens of thousands of Americans who survive trauma inflicted by law enforcement every year are often overlooked. They go without the kind of support our systems offer to survivors of sexual assault, domestic violence, and other forms of trauma. Often, law enforcement also plays a big role in helping those other survivors, such as by funding services and advising providers and policymakers. In this limited series, From Words to Weapons, we'll hear from trauma survivors, police, and other public safety professionals, and the healthcare providers, attorneys, advocates, researchers, and others working with them about the path forward. On this episode, we'll go to Boston to talk to the defendant on a landmark case that made national headlines several years ago and find out how that's affected his life and more about the broader impact. I ended up meeting Jimmy in Boston on an extremely windy afternoon. I'd walked from my hotel downtown, and he'd driven in from Jamaica Plain, a more residential section of the city a few miles away. It was just before his 29th birthday.
My name is Jay. Oh, well, no, I can't say it like that, because I feel like...
Yeah, you can.
All right, what's going on today? Oh, my name is Jay, 28, doing a podcast today, and, Yeah, I don't know. I got to get the words together.
Jimmy is 5'7", a few inches shorter than me. But when he walked in, that didn't strike me so much as his wide smile and quick laugh. He was also wearing intentionally mismatched sneakers, and his hair was in box braids. We quickly established that he doesn't eat breakfast, does drink coffee, and his son, who's just starting kindergarten, is the center of his world. He told me he's been trying to focus on being a good father and working, paying his rent, and dreaming of starting his own business.
Lately, I actually just been in the house, to be honest. I've just been doing everything like online and just staying out in the streets. Either just going to work, coming in. And if I do go out, I go out kind of like far. I don't stay in the city. I attract certain people, so I try to stay away from those type of people, I guess, if you want to say. Those type of people that like to run the streets.
Jimmy definitely doesn't shy away from the fact that he used to be right there with them. But of course, it wasn't always that way either. When Jimmy was 3, his 5-year-old brother Richard and baby sister Gwendolyn died in an accidental fire at the family's apartment.
We all pretty much was like in the hospital, but me and my mother was the only one that made it.
One article says that investigators found the fire escape windows, quote, illegally padlocked and covered with bars. Jimmy was on a ventilator for days.
My father wasn't around. My mom kind of like just drank herself to death.
Jimmy's mother died in 2020. He told me recently he can't remember what she was like when she wasn't drinking.
That's why I kind of like had my anger issues and was running the streets doing kind of like what I wanted to do. School was always difficult for me to pay attention. I disliked the fact that we had to like talk about the same thing for like a week straight. So I kind of like lose focus fast. I was just that kid. I was that bad kid. During lunchtime, I used to leave and go to the corner store and get snacks. And I'm just like, whatever. You tell me to go do something, I'll do it. You want me to go break this car window? I'll go do it. You want me to go trip the teacher? I'll go do it. I wanted to be that guy. So I used to do whatever to be that guy. Bullies, even at a young age. At a young age, I've always had like a bad experience with them. They'll just stop me and like frisk me like mad randomly and then just drive off. Won't even ask questions. Just tell me to shut the fuck up while they search me. Because I'll be asking questions like, yo, what y'all doing hopping out? And they'll just dip like, shut the fuck up. And one will hold me while the other one search me. And they'll just get back in their car and go. Because it was happening around my little neighborhood. So like it was happening to everybody. So I felt like if it wasn't happening to me, then it's not normal. Once I get in a group of like 4 or 5 people, then like we're always getting stopped. We'll be at the train station, we'll get stopped at the train station. We'll get off at the train station downtown, we'll get stopped downtown. But then we'll be walking around downtown, we'll get stopped again downtown. And then like there's one other person, they won't stop us. They'll keep like spinning around type situation, keep like circling the area, but they won't physically hop out. They're coming off aggressive. If they hop out way too fast and they're like, hey, come here. It's like, bro, what I do type situation. So it's like my first instinct is run. It's like, oh, let's get out of here. I'm not about to just sit here and wait. I know a few people that's like gotten hurt growing up a few times.
Police force like that has compounding effects on people who experience it directly, of course, and those who witness it, disproportionately affecting communities of color. Leslie Salas Hernandez is a senior research associate with the Center for Policing Equity. She laid out the mental health implications of this in her dissertation published in 2022.
Dr. Jordan DeWilder, who was on my dissertation committee, conducted two different surveys. The focus was asking people about their experiences with the different types of police violence. In this survey, they asked participants, have you ever experienced? So it's a lifetime exposure measure. And then they define that, the different forms: physical, sexual, neglectful, and psychological police violence. He also asked about vicarious exposure.
Leslie and her team analyzed the survey data looking for patterns, and they found some.
Those that are in the extreme police violence and the high police violence groups, they've both been exposed to high levels of policing overall, as well as positive policing exposures, both directly and vicariously. These folks have experienced a lot of policing contact, and this whole idea of like, they just need to have positive experiences with police. Officer friendly, knocking on doors, saying hello. No, what this is saying is that folks that have experienced high and extreme police violence already have high levels of positive police encounters. They just have a lot of interactions, and maybe they shouldn't have so many interactions.
Leslie's work crystallizes how interactions with law enforcement in over-policed communities and communities of color in particular can affect people. And in Jimmy's case, how it compounded other stresses in his life, and why he ran that night back in 2011, and why he's still afraid of the police.
If you have experienced or you know people that have experienced police violence, that's part of your framing, your reference, that whether you anticipate it, if you live in an over-policed community, you live in a community that has a ton of police activity and it's being surveilled, yeah, we're not trying to pathologize that anticipation of police violence. But there are folks that have been insulated from any form of police violence, and they certainly don't anticipate it. What we will say is that that anticipation of police violence might sit on the pathway to poor mental health outcomes, but we are not saying that it is a mental health outcome.
We'll put a link to Leslie's research in the show notes.
On Obscured, we're covering issues that intersect with politics, government, and accountability. And we wanted to let you know about another show that's diving into big ideas about civic life and democracy. It's called Future Hindsight and is hosted by Mila Atmos. This award-winning podcast features conversations with changemakers and civic innovators and ideas for how citizens like you can take action to change the status quo and stay engaged. Find new episodes of the show every Thursday at futurehindsight.com or wherever you listen to podcasts. Now, let's get back to Obscured.
I used to get pulled over probably like 3 times out the week. That's always like a bad interaction with them. Cops are just unpredictable. You don't know what they're doing, what their mindset is. I mean, to be honest, yeah, I'm still am nervous around them, even with the body camera, because it's like they know their way around the body camera. They do stress you out. They just make you like really like make you real nervous. And like every time I'm around a cop, me personally, my hands get real sweaty and I stutter a lot and I get like really, really nervous. It's just something I can't handle.
When he was a kid, Jimmy found an outlet playing sports.
I played football. I played basketball. I did a little bit of tennis. I was definitely like outdoors, like did a lot of sports. I definitely was interactive with a lot of things. And just as I got older, I kind of like slowed down on it after I broke my collarbone when I was 16.
This was more than a dozen years ago, but hearing the story from Jimmy, it sounded much more recent. It happened while he was at football practice, after he'd been off the field getting some water.
I actually unhooked my shoulder pads, and I forgot to hook them back. One of my friends came up to me, and he was just like, bro, you trying to do kickoff? I just feel too winded. And I was like, bro, I got you. So instead of me like clipping back up, like I just got too excited and just finished drinking the water and ran into the thing. And like, as soon as I pretty much set myself up, I noticed it was unclipped. So I tried to like clip it as I was running, and I thought I did it. So then I kept running, and then the dude caught the ball. I'm chasing him, and I didn't like look at my blind side. So like once I was about to grab him and I looked, my hand was extended, and his friend just came out of nowhere and just like straight helmet first. I flipped, landed, and I thought I was fine because I just like did a couple rolls, boom. So then once I tried to get up, my whole arm just like bloop. And once I like my brain registered to that, the pain just started kicking in. It just felt like it just felt mad hot. And they checked me and they was like, oh yeah, you broke your collarbone.
The injuries sidelined him for the rest of that football season and winter training. Months went by.
I just ended up getting in trouble that whole time because it like took so much time off. So I just felt like getting back into it was just too much work. I was already smoking. I was already doing other things. So it's kind of like, I don't really want to play football no more. My violent time came like right after football was over. Them little 6 months, like I wasn't doing nothing. I had nothing to do. So I kind of like was like breaking into people's shit, taking people's shit, robbing people, taking whatever I needed to get to where I wanted to be.
That included taking a gun. Jimmy says an older guy from his neighborhood gave it to him.
At that age, like, you think it's disrespectful to just say no, like, oh, no. So it's like, you'd be like, yeah, sure, take it, boom.
After you had it, did you feel safer? Did it make you feel different?
No. I still felt the same. Like, I was still the same person. I did kind of, like, get a little bit more aggressive. Instead of more of, like, walking away from a situation, I'll press the situation. I woke up that day. It just seemed like something was wrong, and I just couldn't pinpoint what it was. It was just cold as shit. No, it was freezing that day. I had like 2 sweaters on and a jacket, and I was still cold. And then out the random, I just wanted to get my hair done. So I was like, yo, let's go over here and get my hair done. When we're leaving to go get the hair done, I actually grabbed the pistol, and I'm coming outside. And then my cousin's like, yo, did you grab it? And I'm like, yeah. He's like, nah, just go put it back. We're going around the corner. And I'm like, all right, so then I kind of like act like I was going upstairs, and I faked it, and I still kept it on me.
Jimmy told me later that at this point, he didn't actually want the gun anymore. He had unloaded it and was hoping to sell it.
So then we get there. She said she's not going to do my hair, nothing like that. Da, 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 da. So I was like, damn, you made me come over. If nothing, I would have just stayed at the crib. Like, I washed my hair, blow dried it, everything. I just need like 2-3 braids real quick. Didn't want to do it. We ended up drinking, smoking again over there, left.
Jimmy didn't know it, but this whole time that he was walking around with his cousins and trying to get his hair done, police were investigating a break-in not that far away, and they didn't have much information to go on, as attorney Nelson Lovins explained years later while he was trying to get the state Supreme Court to overturn Jimmy's case.
If you go back, the radio dispatch was that these 3 suspects could have gone in 1 of 2 different directions. That's number one.
And I dropped my cousin off, and then I'm walking with my other cousin, and we're just cutting through.
Number two is that there were 3 suspects and not 2. One of them was wearing a red hoodie. They had a backpack. And when Angels came upon them, neither of them...
Nelson is referring to Jimmy and his cousin right here.
...were wearing a backpack. In addition to that, there was nothing about height, weight, appearance, facial hair, nothing other than that they were young black men, 2 of whom were in dark clothing, 1 of whom was in a red hoodie.
And then that's when I get stopped. Well, try to get stopped, and then that's when I took off. I didn't have time to, one, get rid of the gun on me. The way that like we was boxed in, it kind of like, if I would have turned around and ran the other way, the cop still would have seen me. The cop behind me didn't say nothing because we looked. All he did was flash a light, and then we looked, we turned around, he didn't say come here or nothing like that. Like, you have a big intercom, like, and he didn't use that. So we just kept walking. And then, that's when I see the other car pull the other side, and I just told my cousin, I'm like, yeah, yo, I'm either going to go into jail or I'm going to make it out. And that's when I like the police get, like, as close as you are, and I just turned around and took off running from him.
Do you think you still would have run even if you hadn't had the gun?
If I was by myself, yeah, I would probably would have ran because one, you have one cop at one end and then I'm walking to the other side and you have another cop pulling up. Yeah, I would have felt threatened. I would have felt like y'all trying to do something to me. There's no cameras in this park. I would have been out. I would have took off. Once I turned around and ran, I heard their guns come right off the hip. Like you could hear it like being like coming right off the fucking holster. So I was kind of like, oh shit, like don't stop.
The police did ultimately catch up to Jimmy.
They was like, oh, where's the third guy at? And I'm just looking at them like, third guy? Like, I did have a third person with me, but it was like earlier throughout the day, like, and I walked home with him. Like, I dropped my cousin off.
Police charged Jimmy with trespassing. Eventually, that charge was dropped. But the cops also found a gun close to where they arrested him. He'd admitted the gun was his and that he didn't have a license for it. The unlawful possession of a firearm charge, that one stuck. In Massachusetts, that's at least 18 months in prison. Even though Jimmy was just 17, he was treated as an adult because that's the way the law was at that time in Massachusetts. Jimmy was promptly given an electronic monitoring device, also known as a GPS bracelet, and a curfew between 6 at night and 6 in the morning. Amanda Sheehan was the lawyer who handled Jimmy's case at first.
I had a turret tape that had a recording of all the officer communications. And from all of that, I knew that there was a good motion to suppress the evidence. Everything went incredibly well in terms of the evidence and showing that there wasn't sufficient evidence for them to stop and search him and ultimately recover what they did. The judge viewed it differently.
Amanda told me they considered appealing this initial decision about the evidence. And basically, it just seemed like it was a long shot, so they pressed on.
He was found guilty, but I asked the judge to stay his conviction, to stay the sentencing, which would allow for him to be out while the appeal was pending. And this judge agreed to do it.
Amanda Sheehan did not handle the appeal of Jimmy's conviction. As we've said, that was Nelson Lovins. Basically, in Massachusetts, if someone can't afford an attorney, their case goes to the Committee for Public Counsel, and that entity has a roster of lawyers who take cases. Nelson is one of them. In the meantime, Jimmy had to continue sticking to a curfew and wearing the GPS bracelet, and he had to report to probation. He said it was around this time that his mother stopped working.
I think she was just trying to keep an eye on me.
At first, Jimmy did comply with the terms of his release.
I just wanted to work, really, just to get out the crib and just, like, keep myself busy with stressing about court, going to court. And I've kept trying to tell them, like, I'd rather work than go to school. And they kept trying to force me to go to school. And I'm like, bro, I just can't do it. Like, it's just me and school is not going to click.
So that was the main thing. It was just not going to school. That was the only violation.
And not reporting to probation.
So how many did you miss?
I missed 6 months. So 6 months with appointments, just 10 appointments. I wasn't living with my mother. I was living with my girlfriend at the time. I felt like I was just needing my space.
You know, by all impressions, like, he seemed like a good kid, not a bad kid. But a kid, I think he just, unfortunately, mentality-wise, was just too immature and not recognizing what the real ramifications were going to be if he didn't do what was asked of him. He was quiet, respectful. We had a really good interaction and working relationship. He did have familial support, which is so significant and unfortunately all too lacking very often. You know, I don't know if he just didn't take it seriously. I just don't know if he really truly comprehended what the ultimate consequence would be. He was given several passes by the court. It was almost like a three strikes, you're out. The judge ultimately ended up imposing the sentence of 18 months committed, which is our mandatory minimum for a charge of carrying a firearm. And so he received that sentence and began serving that time while the appeal was ongoing.
Jimmy was sentenced a few days after he turned 20. He'd never been to jail before.
I kind of like got the message, like, you stay under the radar, you don't communicate with COs, you do what you got to do and you stay out the way. And you won't be bothered.
Jimmy had been out of jail for months when his case hit the news.
My mom told me, she's like, go on Google, your case is on Google. So I looked on Google and I was just looking and I was seeing like a lot of journalists. It was just
writing. So I just clicked the first couple ones that I seen, and I definitely read like a couple, a lot of the like the articles, and it was all like stating the same thing. But at that time, I didn't still understand the law, I guess. Me and my mom wasn't really talking when I was incarcerated, so if she did have something to tell me, she probably forgot and just never told me. It never dawned on me to contact my old lawyer or nothing like that. Did peek at it like once in a blue moon, like to read different articles, and like everybody kind of like kept saying the same. Like the article all came to like the ending of saying like it was just injustice, like it was wrong, it wasn't supposed to happen. But it didn't click in my head to like, yo, call your old lawyer. It just kind of never did.
Eventually, Jimmy did talk to his former attorneys in the spring of 2023, conversations that led him to getting his record sealed. In most states, including Massachusetts, a conviction will stay on your record after it's overturned unless you go back to court. Only 20 states have what's called automatic expungement. And that's not a perfect system, as attorneys will tell you. People often end up having to go back to court anyway because somehow the system missed that they're not supposed to have this charge on their record anymore. As you probably recall, Nelson Lovins is the lawyer who got the high-profile ruling from the state Supreme Judicial Court. But before a case gets there, it has to go through a process called appellate judicial review. Nelson told me that this case was at that stage for quite a while before those judges ruled that the case shouldn't go any further.
I was, you shall excuse my language, pissed off and decided I was going to file a petition for further appellate review. And now I get a phone call from the ACLU. ACLU was going bonkers on this. I referred to the field investigation observation study where the Boston police admitted that the numbers of black males who were stopped and frisked disproportionately outnumbered the numbers of non-blacks. The Commonwealth said it was several years old. And how do we know that the statistics were the same? And I pointed out to the chief judge that a more recent FIO had been done, and the statistics were virtually the same.
Eventually, the case did get to the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, and those justices ruled to overturn Jimmy's case, relying in part on the ACLU's report on Boston police statistics and racial profiling, as Nelson's talking about here, and that Carlton Williams, who you heard from at the top of this episode, was involved in pulling together as part of his work for the organization.
I think that Warren is actually more relevant today than it was when the case was decided. Because look at all of the police abuse cases that have reared their ugly heads in the last half dozen years. All of these cases where cops have killed black men, abused black men.
As we've mentioned, Commonwealth v. Warren has been cited in dozens of cases that we could find in Massachusetts alone, in addition to a handful of states where the ruling isn't legal precedent. I reached out to as many attorneys who cited this case as I could, and several of them did make time to talk to me about the practical effects of Jimmy's case. The upshot is that even though it's not exactly straightforward, the ruling has still had an impact as one early on in a succession of decisions, trying to force the legal system to recognize some social realities in what often seems like an almost stubbornly neutral approach.
Warren, I thought, really broke the dam in terms of bringing in, just bringing in race directly and calling it for what it is.
Hayne Barnwell is a criminal defense attorney based in Boston. She cited Jimmy's case in one of hers, where she represented a young black man, 17 years old, just like Jimmy, who had ditched a gun while running from police and was then arrested. The cops were investigating a crime with very little information to go on again, even less than in Jimmy's case. They had no description of the person they were looking for when they arrested Hayne's client. She lost the case, but part of that ruling established something new, using the same logic as in Jimmy's case, that running from the police can be justifiable for people from communities of color or other groups that have a traumatic history with law enforcement. as in Jimmy's case with running, the court held that police really can't give much weight to more subtle behavior, such as avoiding eye contact or stuttering, when they're trying to determine whether someone is suspicious enough to legally justify a pursuit.
Warren was reaffirmed that they expanded on what it means for a young Black man facing a police officer, that it's totally normal from a young Black man's perspective to feel nervous, to run away. And by the way, he was 17 at the time, so he was a child. So you saw a sort of similar dynamic there. And they said, in Warren, we said flight was normal for a young Black man to do when faced with police. And we're going to apply that too to things like nervousness, to averting the gaze, to not wanting to talk to the police. You know, you have a constitutional right. Everybody has a constitutional right, of course, not to talk to the cops. And if you're not under arrest, to walk away from the cops. But with young Black men, if they have certain experiences that a lot of white people don't have with the police, that really matters.
The case did something else, too. Remember, Jimmy was arrested when he was just 17 years old. But back then, in 2011, in Massachusetts, he was considered an adult in the eyes of the law. Since then, Massachusetts has raised that age to 18. That happened years before Haynes' client was arrested at the age of 17. And in this newer case, it was established that just as the cops and courts need to give weight to law enforcement trauma in communities of color, they similarly need to give different considerations to children than they do adults.
So obviously, a kid is going to feel like he or she can't leave in some circumstances when an adult would feel fine to leave. There are situations where I'd feel just fine to walk away from, even though a cop is kind of intimidating, whereas a child would just be so overwhelmed.
We reached out to several organizations to try to get a law enforcement perspective in Massachusetts, but were unsuccessful. Hayne and the other defense attorneys I talked to were quick to point out that these decisions are notable, but their impact can be influenced by a number of factors, like changes in judicial panels. In Massachusetts, for example, Chief Justice Ralph Gantz died in 2020, unexpectedly, of a heart attack at the age of 65, just a few years after another justice had retired, as Carlton Williams also noted.
Jerry Hines is now retired justice from the SJC, who authored the opinion, and she is a Black woman who was a public defender. Like, it's like she understands, and people are thinking in their life experience, right? And they're like, well, I've never run from the police. And I think not everyone has the same experience with the police. That's the thing that people feel very confident about. And there's a quote from John Roberts, right, that says, you must have been doing something. If I can't remember exactly what it is, but like if you're running, you know, there's something about that.
As we mentioned earlier, the government actually raised this argument in its challenge of the state Supreme Court ruling on Jimmy's case. An attempt that was unsuccessful. As for the impact since then, it's one step of many to go.
In the zeitgeist, in the popular opinion, this has given people a foundation to build from. In court, it's something you can put forward to say, well, this person ran. But police have so many abilities. Any police officer can list a set of things that are so subtle. They can always list two or three or four things. I don't think if you asked 100 public defenders in Massachusetts, has Warren changed your litigation practice? Are you winning more cases? I think you would get a lot of eye rolls at that. But if you said, is it good that this decision was made? People would be like, hell yeah, it's quite good for us. But I think it's not a sea change in what's happening.
Next time on Obscured.
Whatever the harm is, the force, the assault, the violence, is its own trauma, of course, then the experience of trying to get some manner of recognition or justice for that harm is where these shields that I'm describing come into play. And they can create, and often do create, their own secondary trauma of having to fight so hard against extraordinary odds to get some manner of justice.
UCLA law professor Joanna Schwartz talks with us about the structural barriers to police accountability. My colleague Stephanie Marudis and I interviewed Schwartz after reading her recent book, Shielded: How the Police Became Untouchable. In the meantime, for more about Obscured and the rest of our work, keep up with us on social at Kuvenda Media. Obscured's From Words to Weapons series is produced by Kuvenda Media and mixed by Brad Linder. Our series was edited by Diane Hodson and fact-checked by Chelsea Zhu. Malik Calhoun composed the music for this episode and the rest of our series. Special thanks to Jennifer Merrigan and Hannah Cooper, to our fiscal sponsor, Media Alliance, and Obscured's founding supporters. You can help more people discover Obscured by leaving us a review on your favorite podcast app and sharing it with others who might be interested. Stephanie Maroudis is Kuvenda Media's executive producer and Obscured's co-creator. And I'm Emily Previty, the executive editor and co-creator of Obscured. Thanks for listening.